We now have the great honor of hearing from one of Chalice's longtime friends, Shoshana Brower. Shoshana is a social activist, a world traveler, and author who has spent years trying to improve the lives of diverse communities. Her love of history and culture led her to Albania, where she discovered how Muslim and Christian Albanians worked to save over 2,000 Jews during the Holocaust. She shares that inspiring story with us now. Thank you, Shoshana. Welcome.
I have to change my glasses. So I won't see you all too well, but I'll see my what I need to. Okay. So I want to take you all with me. Can you hear me through the microphone?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to take you all with me to Albania. Now, first slide, or second slide. Many of you might not know where Albania is, and I certainly didn't know myself when I first started to do this. It's a small country just above Greece. Now, that's where we're going to go together. I want you to think of how you might respond to this question. And you can just, you know, think to yourself, if bad people were coming into your neighborhood, into your community, and they were hunting down your neighbors, hunting down strangers that might be in the community, would you be willing to hide these people at risk to yourself and your family? Now, I've asked myself that question quite a few times. And to be honest, I don't really know if I could. But the people I'm going to tell you about, they didn't stop for a moment to think about that question and what their answer would be. They took it on as their responsibility, their code of honor that they live by. So I want to give you some context to where this all began. In 2017, I went to Oxford University for a class. And while I was in the town, I had to take a taxi. The taxi driver was friendly. We had this great conversation. He asked me my name. I said, Shoshana. What does that mean, he asked. I said, it means rose in Hebrew. He got all excited. And he said, Hebrew, like in Israel? I said, yes. He proceeded then to very proudly tell me this story, that he was from Albania, that he was part Muslim and part Christian, and that the Jews were all saved in Albania by the other citizens there. And what he very proudly told me about was that his grandfather fought in the resistance. So and he also said how everybody got along, the Christians, the Jews, the Muslims, and the Roman Catholics. And they all, in fact, he said, sometimes Christians would go to Muslims' homes on Ramadan, and Muslims would go to Christian homes on Christmas. They saw everyone as equal. I thought this was quite an amazing story, and I started to investigate. To my surprise, I discovered, as Nika mentioned, that Albania started off with 200 Jews who lived in their country. And by the end of the war, they ended up with 2,000 Jews. The only country in the world that had more Jews at the end of the war than less. Now, when the Germans entered Tirana, which is the capital, they set up a puppet government. And the head of the puppet government was Albanian. And unbeknownst to the Nazis, the head of the government let a secret notice go out to all the citizens that they were to save all the Jews and that they were to make fake passports for them as well. I was just amazed by all of this. They actually, when the Nazis kept asking for a list of Jews, the head of the government, the puppet government, kept refusing, and they never did give up that list. So I felt puzzled, and this is part of what drew me to this story. How is it that there are so many countries in this world, including our own, where there is so much hatred towards the other. Yet here is a country, a tiny country, one that most people have never even heard of, where the citizens believe and live by a code of honor called BESA, to keep the promise and take care of others. Now, BESA dictates that there are no foreigners, only guests, and that guests must be protected at all costs. It's central to Albanian life and central to national identity. So I decided I needed to understand this. I wanted to know what this BESA was really about. So since I was going to that area of the world, I arranged for a guide and went to Albania. This was just a few months ago. I wanted to interview people whose family members had saved Jews. I felt compelled to hear their stories. Day after my arrival, my guide and translator, Eddie, introduced me to Tosi, a Muslim. He burst with pride as he played Israeli music as we first sat down at the temple, at the table, sent to him from a friend in Jerusalem. I felt so delighted. I knew this music. It just took me to experiencing that meaningful connection to being Jewish. As he played the music, I wanted to get out of my chair, take his hands, pull him out of his chair, and teach him how to do the hora, an Israeli dance. Now, I didn't do that, but I was thinking about it as I was listening to this music. Then he showed me certificates and medals that his father, Bakir, received from Yad Vashem, the most prestigious Holocaust museum in the world, located in Jerusalem, where he was referred to as righteous among the nations, a title that is given by many Holocaust museums for those who saved Jews during the Holocaust. Now, Tosi proceeded to tell me his family's story. As we sat in the very courtyard, in front of the very house where Avram was hidden for 6 months, and I could look up to the window on the second floor and know that that was the bedroom he lived in, where he was protected. It was isolating, but he was safe. He was saved. Since he was part of a large family, they divided the family up into different homes for their safety. As well, an Eastern Orthodox priest made fake passports for Avram and his family. After 6 months, the Nazis began circling their community. Tosi dressed Avram up as a local villager, and they were going into the mountains so he could stay with other family members. As they approached and began their ascent, a group of Nazis came up to them, and they had one Albanian with him who he was their translator. And the Nazis said, go find out if there are any Jews amongst this group. So he went, he chatted with them for a few minutes, and he came back to the Nazis. He said, no, they're all local villagers. And he knew full well that there was a Jew amongst them. So for a while there, Tosi and Avram's heart is just pounding. And now they took a sigh of relief, and they went up into the village in the mountains. Avram stayed with the family for a year until the war ended. At that time, Avram's father kissed the hand of Tosi and said, thank you so much for saving my son. We will never forget you. Also, when the war ended, Tosi saw Avram take something out of his pocket and said to him, no, we don't want any money. We did this for honor. After the war, communists took over the country for 30 years. It was very, very difficult times. And they wanted the Jews to stay because they actually saw them as very clever people. Avram spoke several languages. He stayed and worked as an economist starting at 25 years old. He defied the Nazis by moving to Israel and living to age 91. People in the neighborhood referred to Tosi and his family as a Jewish family. Very puzzling, since they were Muslim. And this was because they protected the Jews. They felt very proud of this, and they took it as a compliment. Tosi promised his dad that he would carry on his legacy. so that people will know what happened and that it would not be forgotten. Hiding Jews in plain sight seemed to be a common theme. An Albanian woman I spoke to in California told me that her grandfather had a shop in Albania that sold food. And meanwhile, he hid two or three Jews in his shop, dressed them up like locals, and they helped out in the shop. And one day he wanted to ride his horse and go to Yugoslavia to buy and sell food. And he took one of the Jewish men with him who looked like one of the villagers. Fortunately, they were safe. They made it there. They made it back, but hidden in plain sight. The next day, we went to visit Ayet, an incredibly old, beautiful mountain town called Berat. His father had been a blacksmith. While the war tore through nearby countries, a young Jewish man found Ayet's family. He felt so scared that he would not even tell them his name. So the shopkeepers ended up calling him Boy. They wanted to hide him in their homes, but he said no. He just felt it wouldn't be safe enough. So they set up a place for him at the back of the shop with a bed, and they brought him food. During the day, he helped the blacksmith, pretending to be a local. They think he was 18 years old from Yugoslavia. The day he went to leave, he was given some money by Ayet's father. And he said, "The only thing I want to know is let me know when you get to your destination." And unfortunately, he never heard from him again. And he figured that he had probably died. And he thought, "I don't even know his name." During this time, the Nazis checked some nearby houses. But fortunately, they never checked the shop. Ayet's father gave the boy money, as I told you. As Ayet spoke, he kept referring to Bessa, and that it meant just to be nice, to show kindness. It sounds like such a simple thing. Nobody told them about it. It was just a natural behavior passed down from generation to generation. When they saw a local family taking in a Jewish family, they did the same. "You come to my house, I will protect you." Many other Jews were also hidden in this neighborhood. As Nazis got closer, Jews would then leave and go to another home into another community in order to be safe. Many came from Russia, Turkey, Poland, Greece, former Yugoslavia. Initially, the Jews came from Spain during the Inquisition, and they would go to the port and work in the trade, and there was actually a street called the Jewish Road at that time. Then I met Fatima in Krusha, who had a similar story. Her grandfather, Suleiman, met a family of seven in the streets. They said they were homeless, and they were also Jewish. Of course, he showed them hospitality and kindness and invited them into his home. His children played with their children. The grandmother fed them and cleaned them up. They became like family. And the people in the neighborhood also referred to them as the Jewish family, Fatima's family, again Muslim, felt like this was a compliment. They were proud to be called that. She then mentioned Bessa, no one telling on anyone. She said even the bad people in the neighborhood didn't disclose because of the code of honor. During the communist era, they weren't allowed to talk about what happened. Suleiman did tell his son, but nobody else. When the country became independent, the family left and moved to Israel. At some point, they came back to thank them. And this is a picture of Rot, by the way. Fatima proudly showed me the certificate, another one from Yad Vashem for Suleiman. Then Eddie took me to visit his best friend, Gladiola, whose family has lived in their house for six generations from the mid-1800s. The cool part was the house was on the grounds of a 4th-century castle, which we saw on the slide just before this one. First, she gave me a tour of her home, including old photos and mannequins dressed in the traditional clothing of those days. The house felt sturdy and impenetrable, and you had to go up quite a hill in order to get to the castle and then to the house. She told me that during the war, a family down the road hid Jews for 6 months. Now, here's a little twist to this story. At the same time, 8 Germans came to their home and said, "We're going to live here for 3 months." Okay? Well, the family was frightened. They weren't really happy about this, but they had no choice. So her grandmother fed them, took care of them, cleaned up after them, and she was pregnant at the time. While they were there, she gave birth to Gladiola's father. She repeated what was often said because they never knew that there were Jews hiding down the block. So even if you disliked your neighbor, you would never report that anyone was hiding a Jew because of that code of conduct, Bessa, and you would be disrespected. In anticipation of these conversations, I prepared a series of questions, which I never had to ask one of them. They were so excited and eager to tell me their stories so that I could understand why they not only helped Jews who were from their own country, but 2,000 more. As I reflect on these interviews and these wonderful, gracious people, I ask myself again, could I have done what they did? I still don't know. In this case, it was just not individuals, but a national consciousness, a cultural institution of Bessa that emphasizes aiding and protecting people in moments of need. The world should take notice. Now, I want to tell you one more little story, which is the next slide. I also went to Sarajevo, and in a museum there, they had the Sarajevo Haggadah, which is very beautiful, as you can see. The Sarajevo Haggadah, and the Haggadah is the book we use during a Passover Seder that we read. The Sarajevo Haggadah is from the year 1350. It first was purchased by a family in Spain in 1350. 1492, the Jewish family left Spain because of the Inquisition and went to Italy. It was there, passed down, until it was sold to the museum in 1895. Now, part of the reason I'm telling you this story is because then World War II arrives, and they're worried that the Nazis are going to come and take this Haggadah. So one of the men who worked there goes up into the mountains, goes to a Muslim cleric, and the Muslim cleric takes the Haggadah and hides it in the middle of the pages of a Quran. And he keeps it there until the end of the war when he returns it to the museum. I get the chills when I tell this story. It's just a continuation of what we saw in Albania. People doing good, and the world should take notice. So thank you. Thank you, Mika. This is actually the first time I've done a presentation on it, so I really want to get the word out to as many people as possible. I'll be here later if you have any questions. Or
thank you so much, Shoshana. What amazing stories of courage and goodness and really holding to your values. Incredible, inspiring. And of course, although, you know, we as Unitarian Universalists might be new to the Albanian idea of Bessa, we, I think, share similar values in our faith, always encouraging us to consider how we might act if we center love and if we remember the values of generosity and equity and that we're all interdependent with one another. And so with whatever may come this week, I invite us to keep asking the question, how can we help? So many of you help in a multitude of ways here already. You make meals for unhoused folk. You collect clothing and supplies for those in need. You write postcards to encourage people to vote. You give rides to people to get to the polls or to doctor's appointments. And you help the elderly and sick with shopping and meal trains and so much more. And I want to thank you for your kindness and your service and for centering love in the way that you do, the way you choose to help in this world. It's really extraordinary and inspiring. So as these days and months unfold before us, I encourage us all to look for new ways to help. Who is struggling with mental health issues or low income? Who might feel unsafe? Who needs us here in the Conejo Valley? Seeing how we might welcome and help another is one of the best antidotes to helplessness, confusion, and fear. And it takes us out of ourselves and gives us a larger purpose to be a part of. So whatever happens, whatever lies ahead for our country, let us all reflect on how we might help. What's our role? As a community, we are so much more resource than we could ever be alone. And we're stronger and more resilient together. We are here for each other, as Matt mentioned earlier. May it be so.